Welcome to Rambling Through the Brambles.
I'm Clark Taylor.
And I'm Hobart Taylor. We're finding our way through the thicket of black-white racial entanglement.
Season 1, Black Music in White Hands. All right, we are rolling.
Okay.
It's another episode of Rambling Through the Brambles with Clark Taylor. That's me.
And Hobart.
Yeah, and there he is. There's Hobart.
Right there.
Good, good. It's always good to get together with you, my old friend.
Yeah, thanks.
And continue work on our, really, I think this project has a lot of potential. It's a lot of great things about it.
And it's potential, that's like saying, you know, the girl's got personality.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got more than potential.
And I think we're just kind of
something going on.
Trying to get it out the barn.
Unique. I've been looking for other stuff, comparables. Like when you buy a house, you look for a comparable. When you do a show like this, you know, you try and find other shows that are trying to do this. And so far, I haven't found anybody who's, got the same sort of take that we do.
We are American originals.
Mm. What's different about us is that we're trying to end all of this with a certain freshness, innocence, and newness, not assuming that we're taking positions or that we have anything that, you know, really educate anybody about, but just educating ourselves through conversation and talking about race in a way that is really, really personal and not subscribing to any particular orthodox.
Yeah. And I think we're trying to be really, really honest. We're trying to take some chances and get into some subject areas that we're rambling through the brambles. I think that was the best title you could have come up with when you did. It really was perceptive, and the more we do it, the more it seems like the right title, because it's not like we're going to say solving race, two guys, figure it out. You know, I think there's a lot of brambles. There's a lot of thickets. There's a lot of dark and strange new places that we're trying to access.
So for anyone who's like listening to the podcast for the first time, say right quick what we're doing. I'm black, Clark's white. We're both in the sunset years here, but we've known each other for a long time. And we have had a relationship that has not been based on race. It's been based purely on a sort of sense of kinship. And I have been pretty much ensconced in the white middle and upper class world all my life, even from childhood. And Clark grew up in the South and has chosen to investigate black history and black culture. And so we both have knowledge that comes from our choices in terms of being involved with the quote unquote opposite race, but they're not opposite races, of course. They're all part of the American continuum.
And that we feel like what we're doing has some import, some value, some real true value. Right. So for us, hopefully people will believe, the truth, which is we're old friends and we've kind of always been old friends. Like as soon as we met, I think we were old friends.
Definitely. That's what I remember. You know, so there's a good chance somewhere way back there we're related. Plantations being what they were.
I don't know. Taylor is pretty common.
Yeah. But Louisiana and Texas are close enough.
They are. Yeah. And old Jim Bowie operated
East Texas anyway too.
Yeah. And you know, my small town, the small town nearest my house growing up, Madisonville, Louisiana, was the home of a guy whose name I should know but don't. But he funded Stephen F. Austin. Austin came from Louisiana to go to Texas, and this guy bankrolled him. Whole operation.
Yeah,
a couple of times.
Yeah,
bailed him out.
Yeah, you know? Big Texas Louisiana connection. So I want to talk about something, maybe see what you think. We did a couple of shows where we just did autobiographical stuff. Like the first time we realized that there was a different race, or we had a show called First Encounters. And I want to maybe raise a different question. What are some of the attitudes that we have that we take for granted about generalizations we make about race, about white culture, about black culture? And I know some people joke and they pretend that they don't really believe some of these things, but I want to you know, like, leap in and see what are the assumptions and prejudices. And I know I have built-in prejudices about both black and white culture. I, like many black people of a certain age and a certain class, really are trying to, like, overcome stereotypes and as a result sort of believe on an emotional level some of the stereotypes and you know, self-denigrate or see a character defect as being a feature of race. So if I choose not to do something, or if I'm slow or procrastinate, even though I know in my heart of hearts that that's a personal, individual activity, I'll still think of it as being quote unquote black and lazy. Similarly, if someone is cold and unsharing, you know, sort of distant, and they're white, I'll think of them as being soulless or not engaged in being real, but engaged in sort of maintaining the upper hand that's a part of the racial dynamic. And I know that on an intellectual level, both of those things are not generally or always true. But I also know that the specific instances where I'll just operate off of my racism. I'll get into specifics later on, but what's your thought on all that?
Yeah, I'm trying to compare what you're talking about to what I'm talking about. And I think it's interesting. Your point of view is much more internalized than mine, I think, by necessity. So you're having to operate internally about race in real ways that are much more intricate and much more involved. And you see, I'm talking about what you just told me. So I'm trying to equate it to how I am, which is much less is required of me in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And that's just true about being, I guess, about being white and being myself, is that I can walk, and this is just kind of me, like I can walk into a room full of black people and feel completely at ease. But that said, there's also a little hair on the back of the neck thing about, first of all, being presumptuous enough to believe that I can walk into this room and not be otherwise concerned about racial difference, but just what's going on in the space. But I, you know, if I'm in an unfamiliar area, so the other day when I was riding with our friend Royce Martin, he had a piano. He was playing a piano in the back of my pickup truck, and we were driving around North St. Louis while he's playing piano. And I realized, first of all, later, that I'm probably the white guy that I know personally whose story of that day at my age, in my 60s, would include driving a young piano player around North St. Louis so he could play Scott Joplin tunes. Not a lot of my peers would ever have done that or have added that to their day. But to me, it was just pure joy and a lot of fun. We got to a gas station to drop off one of the guys with us, Nick Lowry, who you know. And we're standing in the parking lot, and there's a few sketchy characters in the parking lot. And when I, by that, I mean literally sketchy characters. They're not just the folks hanging out or working at the gas station, but it was right there on Kings Highway. And Royce and Nick have gone inside, and they're kind of hanging out. And I'm kind of hanging out with the truck because I want to keep an eye on my truck, which is in the parking lot. But that's when the racial difference kicks in. If I'm at a regular gas station somewhere, wherever, random USA, I'm not overly concerned that somebody's going to steal a piano out of the back of the truck or even try to break it. You know what I mean? But I felt like I couldn't leave my truck, right? Then there's a few people moving across the parking lot. And at that point, I thought, I need to be inside the building rather than outside the building. So it was funny. I'm like, I should be watching the truck. No, I should be going inside and patting, being real nice to Roy. Hey, guys, how's it going? You know, because mm-hmm. I'm the white guy in this whole scene. And so there was a certain amount of nervousness that I was experiencing strictly from, for most part, from racial prejudice. You know, just concern for my white self, feeling myself as a sort of a beacon of opportunity.
But I wonder,
does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. But I'm wondering whether that's entirely a racial situation. I mean, you're talking about a situation where, as you said, the characters are sketchy, and you're making the determination that through body language or through some other way, the signaling danger or hostility, and it may not be the fact that they're black. It may be the fact that they're in a situation in a place where it's not unusual for people to act out in certain ways.
I mean, given who I was with, I felt pretty safe. Mm-hmm. But as they spent some time inside their thing, I started to have a little bit of nervous, and I attribute it to racial nervousness, if I can put it. I think that's really what it was, more a little anxiety, a little racial mm-hmm. anxiety in mm-hmm. that situation. So I have experienced racial enmity, you know, animus in certain situations over my life, you know, and so I guess some of that kind of kicks in. But in general, you know, my mind is not operating like yours is. Right. My mind, and I think that's probably as much racially based as anything, especially given our reading, as I have gone through Shelby Steele's book and Frantz Fanon, and how much needs to be or is internalized by black folk to negotiate their way through the life. As a white person, I just simply don't have the responsibility to act a certain way, think a certain way, mm-hmm. except out of simple human respect. And when I look back on my behavior in some of these situations, like I used to go to Kemp's all the time by myself and just listen to the Rebirth Brass Band play in New Orleans. That was a very black environment. I would be the white guy, hundreds of people in this, right next to the Magnolia Street Projects. But I was just like, wanted to be there. I loved being there. And so I realized later and was told by some people a little bit, indicated that my white privilege was showing in that regard, because I'm showing up there and just because I'm white, it's like, and I don't mean this in the extreme. I've just, as somebody's told me, it's like the master showing up. You know, it's like the white guys here, we got to make sure, you know, don't offend him or be whatever, that I take that it's taking it's disrespectful in that it's assuming that I'm going to be not messed with. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, I think so.
And for me, you know, like there's a difference. I would feel more comfortable in that club than I would in some country Western bar out in the country. Mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. when you go to those places, everybody spins around on their bar stools and looks at you. Mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. the hell this guy come from? Mm-hmm. I don't care who you are. Mm-hmm. And you got to kind of watch your back a little bit because somebody might come over and go, where the hell are you from? You know, and there's a lot of weird tribal suspicion in places like that. Whereas for some reason it camps, you know, it's just not there. Everybody's there for the music, right? And the good time.
You know, that's interesting because what you're talking about is, it sounds to me like I have the experience of what Du Bois calls double vision, the double consciousness, mm-hmm. always mm-hmm. seeing myself as an American and as a black person and trying to reconcile the two in every interaction. And ironically, that's not just in interactions with whites, but it's in interactions and mixed situations, and it's an interaction with black people, particularly black people who I sense in some way are quote unquote more black than I. And whereas you don't have that same pressure of double consciousness, except right. that you have a sort of the awareness of being the other. Or a limited awareness, mm-hmm. but you know, you were talking about like in a weird way, like going into camps and then like you know there, then you're accepted and then it passes, and that's because I think in a lot of situations what people don't talk about is the fact that there are always people who pass, white people who are black people accepted as being. Honorary black or part of the black culture, or you know, they just get a vibe off of those people, and mm-hmm. so they immediately like all of that other stuff is put in a corner of the mind. And I've had a similar experience of like I lived in Houston in the 70s, and I became a part of the singer songwriter. Folk scene, which was all white. And, you know, I mean, it's Lyle Lovett and Nancy Griffith and Eric Taylor, and I worked with Lucinda Williams for a while and all the rest of it. But it was like, it was not the sense of being either rejected or accepted. It was as if I passed through the looking glass. And was recognized as a part of the of that community, hadn't really thought of it as being particularly exceptional until looking back over 50 years later and recognizing that there was a There was a time when people were really attempting to live in a world where they recognized that there were differences in cultures, but they were striving to work toward what it was that people had in common, and they really made the conversation about what they had in common, and not about reaching out to what they have in common, but just plain old. Being people together. I mean, mm-hmm. a weird thing to say, but it was there.
Yeah, Steele, I believe it is, and Shelby Steele in his book, points to a real demarcation between that time period, late 60s, early 70s.
The content of our character.
The content of our character, which you're reading, and I've just finished reading, and I would recommend to anybody and everybody. I found it instructive for my own life as a white person outside of the racial, lessons that it teaches in a way, talking to black people about their et cetera. Anyway, I found it instructive for my own self, just as a psychological treatise on fear and how you react to things in your environment, regardless of skin color. He talks about how, and certainly McWhorter talks about this again, a separate voice, as we understand, but that the 80s and 90s brought out an entirely different, more siloed and more individuated reality that has gone against what you're talking about. In other words, there was this period post, 60s when the civil rights happened. And then after the 60s, which you're talking about that era in the late 60s, early mid 70s into the 70s, when that there was kind of that moment that you're describing very well. And then things backslid after that in a way, and what that means, we don't know. You know, the 80s and 90s.
It's probably one of the things that sort of been the subtext in my reading of Steele and others has been that there's been a commodification of race, and we talk about genre when we've done a couple of shows about music, and we had a series called Black Music in White Hands, and about how the need for genres based on the need to create sell markets and create an identity in order to market to and create brand loyalty and all the rest of it. It feels like there's been a commodification of race as well, that on one level there's a recognition of the fact that there wasn't adequate information or recognition of the contributions of African Americans to American culture, American life, or an American identity, and that there was a definite need for Black pride because for so long there'd been nothing but promulgation of Black shame. But the other side of it is carrying it to the extent that it becomes exclusionary. And when it becomes totally exclusionary, then it becomes something that you can market, something you can sell, a product, identity as a product. That's a tough nut to crack. That's a hard one to think about.
Yeah, and taking advantage of, at least from Steele's perspective, of psychological disadvantage. So if you're innocent, you have power, and then if you express that power, you lose the power. There's these dense ironies that occur as you transition from a benighted race to Black power and all that. And he looked at that, and I agreed in my mind that there's an interesting imbalance occurs when you say, well, I'm Black and beautiful and I'm Black and powerful and white people are racist. And I'm rising above that. What the argument is that all you're doing is perpetuating the racism, and that's where the commodification comes from, and the maintenance of that otherness and the maintenance of that divide. I'm just kind of trying to put together some markers.
Okay, this is how it's played out in my life, and I'd be interested to see how it's played out in yours. I find that I'm constantly wondering whether or not if there's an injustice or something that happens that's bad to me or a member of my family, whether or not there's an element of racial animus in that, particularly if there's an injustice involving an institution, the interactions with the police, I can talk about that I've seen in my life and in my family's life. Certainly, interaction with the school system and other institutions. Whether or not those are being setting up a dynamic of a hostility, that overreaction on the part of each, and mindfulness around that, or whether or not you know, I mean, I don't see it as categorical. I don't see it as either or. I think it's entirely situational. And I found. Let me go to a specific example. I've lived in Irvine, California, for 22 years.
You have lived.
Yeah, I have.
Continue to live there.
Just like and, the audience. I've been pulled over. I have an older car. Always have had an older car, which is maybe a marker in California. But I've been pulled over a lot. And when I've been pulled over, it seems like I've gotten more tickets when I just talk to other people anecdotally. You know, if I run a stop sign, or if I stop for 3 seconds, I'm the one that gets a ticket, and I hear everyone else saying, you know, they've been let go, and then, you know, you sort of wonder whether or not, it, strangely enough, there's a pattern, or am I being paranoid? And I just don't have any way of determining that other than the fact that I talk to any number of people who've never been pulled over, and so I just have to ask myself over and over again, am I buying into the idea that there's a difference? When I see the judge doesn't, you know, cut me any slack. Does the judge not cut me slack and cut other people slack, and why, you know? It's having that question in your mind that makes you buy in to the notion that the racism is there, it's always there, and that people who are busy denying they're racist often are the most racist, because they're trying to prove they're not racist by applying their authority and their power in a way that they consider to be representative of the fact that, oh, well, in this case, what I'm doing is right, it's justified, and it's not racial. Mm-hmm. I just don't know. And that's that twilight zone. That's what drives me crazy, and it particularly drives me crazy when I see it applied to other family members or other situations where I can see those people are even more sensitive and more vulnerable, and I really feel for them.
So my reaction is the quick reaction is I have a story which I never really talk about or tell, but I believe was fully racist to me, from some black nurses at the Oakland Hospital where my son was born in 1996, and the L&D department was in the process of being taken down. They didn't even exist a month later. So there was a lot of uproar going on. But the night he was born, it was just the way I was treated, the way we were treated by the nursing staff was so bald-facedly antithetical to what you would experience as a new baby, with a new baby, and just having given birth, which was itself insane. There was no doctor present. The nurses ignored us. We had one nurse who basically saved everybody's lives in this empty hospital. But after, there was a lot of anger towards myself and my wife and the mother of my son, and it was very unnerving, so much so that we were just like, I was thinking about just scooping them up and running out of the hospital. It was very, very scary because it was at night and it was late at night, and they were made me and then forced me to leave the hospital, these women. And I've never thought of it as anything but just complete, because there were other people in there who were allowed to stay. They were being really nice to this person and totally mean to us It was really obvious. And so my point of you talking is that I'm saying one of the things that I have, I'm guessing, is I would tell you absolutely that's racist, what's happening to you. You don't need to wonder. You're being pulled over because you're black. That's why you're being pulled over. You're being pulled over because somebody's trying to express their own individual attitude about a black man driving a car. But white people probably more than you're living in the, well, I hope it's not, but maybe it is. And I'm in the world of like, yeah, I see it. I can see that. I know the difference between human interaction and a racist attitude, you know. But I do, my argument also that it happens, it's two sides of the street. You know, there's racist, there's black racist, there's white racist, there's racism, and you know. I grew up in the South. I grew up with, you know, holy cow, right? So anyway, that's all I would say.
So I agree with you. I mean, I know intellectually that's racist, and I'm not being Pollyanna about it, and being a little coy around all this. But the point I'm really making is that experience engenders in me a racist attitude toward all white police. That engenders in me a racist attitude toward quote unquote white institutions, because I recognize and so the cycle continues. I have an attitude. They have an attitude. I express the attitude. They express the attitude. Or they passively, aggressively deny the fact that they have the attitude. But still pursue the injustice. And so I got to recognize the fact that regardless of what the impetus is, I have an attitude, you know. And I have a really strong attitude toward what I consider to be the dehumanized and impersonal nature of what I consider to be American white culture, which is
to speak directly to that is that there's a lot less white culture in white culture than there is black culture in black culture. Does that make sense? Like something that, you know, our readings imply is that by creating a black universe of black culture and black empowerment, et cetera, in a way you're also creating a white culture that is its counterpoint. When in fact, once the breaks in the dike happen, the flow across the chasms can't so in when I was in high school at a little high school in the early 70s in Louisiana, we had just integrated. We integrated when I was in seventh grade, so this is just 3 or 4 years later, and we're in this integrated high school. One fascinating thing that happened was this black girl won homecoming queen when I was a junior, and I wish I could remember her name. And everybody knew why she won, because she was the perfect homecoming queen. Like, as kids, she was the preeminent. She was absolutely gorgeous, total sweetheart, like the whole nine yards. And not, she was just the perfect person to have as your homecoming queen. And she won that year, partly because the country boys who used to kind of control the thing, voting for each other's girlfriends, trying to get one of their girlfriends to get it, voted against each other. But I voted for her. A lot of people voted for her because the football team votes for the homecoming queen. It's elected. They were elected by the homecoming, by the football team. We were the voters for the homecoming. And so,
the dynamics of that. But
that's right. Totally ridiculous. But from then on, the next year, Because she walked across the field and she got her crown. Her dad was so proud. And she was just a total sweetheart, right? The next year, they went to a double homecoming queen. They immediately said, oh, we can't have that. So they had a white and a black homecoming queen from then on, which is insane.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm sure they probably could
white people vote for the black and the black people vote for the white.
No, I think the black kids voted for their homecoming queen and the white boys voted because it was all the football team. There's not that many people, maybe what, 75 kids. And so from then on, they split it. But that one year, so that would be 1974. That one year, there was a black homecoming queen, and probably the last homecoming queen who deserved the honor of being homecoming queen was this young woman.
Right.
But there was also some interracial dating going on that everybody knew about because it's a small school. And it didn't involve – there was no – it didn't have to be hidden or behind the scenes. Everybody kind of knew that Shelby was dating whoever the girl's name – his name was Shelby, I remember, and so there was some cross-racial stuff happening in this little one moment of time before the institutions, as you say, stepped in to incorporate difference.
Right.
Right? There was this brief moment of shared interest in each other's young selves that lasted one year, you know, from, and that was fascinating. And I think of that often. There was also a kid named Jimmy Broadwell. Well, that's not the right name, but he was a super smart black kid. And, you know, everybody knew him. He's probably the president of some, you know what I mean? He had a successful life. Anyway, but maybe one of the smartest kids in schools was a black kid. So there was, you know, there was recognition of excellence and appreciation for each other. High school was 40% black.
It sounds like for a moment, and people talk about this also too, when there's a critical mass, when there's enough black and white people in a situation, or when there's so few that somebody stands out as the exemplar. There's a moment when people were able to be recognized as individuals and not as representatives. In the beginning, it sounds like they were representatives of the race, but it was also that the unique personality was the factor that stood out in the description of them, that's really you know, a double-edged sword too, because sometimes people just want to be like normal. They just want to be like fit in and not be the super person, and not be the example, right. But just be, you know, be taken for granted and have interactions that are relaxed and casual
and in our school, you know, our coach Jack Salter, who was one of the finest men I've ever known in my life and a model for everybody.
Well, you are a Southern
boy. In this town. Yeah, Jack Salter, the football coach. He was the first non-racist white man I ever knew, right, in my life.
Uh-huh.
And he ran the high school, and he wasn't going to have any of it. He wasn't going to have any. He when they integrated the pool, the Covington, Louisiana pool got. Was there forever, and they integrated. You know, they said you have to let everybody swim in this pool. So, what did you think they did with that pool, Hubbard?
Of course, the same thing that happened all over the South. They closed
it
down.
With concrete.
Exactly, all over the South. You can go if you go in Atlanta and the parks, you can go see all these areas that used to be pools. You know,
they're parking lots. Right. They're paved over parking lots in the shape of a pool.
Right.
And It was just insane, right? The adults were insane, and we knew that pretty much early in the process of integration, that the adults were kind of crazy, and their solutions were all a fear-ridden madness, which translates to the kids, of course. But Jack Salter had a pool in his backyard, and he would bring black kids that he knew and kids from the high, football teams, et cetera, to swim at his house,
right,
which was right by the pool, the city pool.
Right.
And so he'd have all these black kids, play with white kids and everybody together in his backyard, jumping and swimming.
Right.
That's the kind of, so you have people like that in the town, and he ran. He could have been mayor if he'd wanted. He could have been president of the world if he wanted in our town.
Fortunately, that's why, things didn't break down entirely. And why things don't break down entirely, because there are always people of goodwill everywhere.
And he's the football coach.
Right.
So he's like, he's the capo di capo of a town, Friday Night Lights town like we were in,
Right.
Well,
this has been a fascinating chance to sort of bring out some of our memories and some of our thoughts and a little bit more of ourselves, put ourselves into the show. And it's fun to talk about topics. It's also fun from time to time to explore each other in order to share with everybody. What is personality and the individual and the common human bond, and what is nature nurture? What is a part of the culture or the cultural influences that we've had and shared?
Yeah, I think it's great. I love it, and it's scary but good.
All right. Well, this has been Ramblings Through the Brambles, and I'm Hobart Taylor. And
I'm Clark Taylor. We thank you for tuning in.
Yeah. See you next time. Bye-bye.
See you next time. Bye.